Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit and nonpartisan forum open to the public. To attend a Commonwealth Club event, check out our program listing at www.commonwealthclub.org. Now we join today's program of the Commonwealth Club.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to tonight's program of the Center for Literary Arts and the Student Union, Inc. of San Jose State University and the Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley, brought to you from San Jose City Hall. My name is Mitch Berman, and I will be your chair for this program. In September 2002, a 29-year-old Iraqi architect calling himself Salam Pax began posting daily accounts of life in Baghdad on his internet weblog, or blog, entitled Dear Ayad, risking retribution from Saddam Hussein's regime for the criticism he voiced so openly. The vitality and fearlessness of Salam Pax's writing, as well as the mystery of his identity, gained the Baghdad blogger, as he became known, a worldwide following, and led to speculative stories by CNN, The New Yorker, The Village Voice, and many others. He continues to live in Baghdad, maintaining a new blog called Shut Up, You Fat Whiner, writing for The Guardian of London, and shooting and producing video blogs for the BBC that have shown at the Rotterdam Film Festival and received the Royal Television Society's Award for Innovation. Slate.com calls Salam Pax the most famous and the most mysterious blogger in the world. More than that, we feel that his blog now stands as the most vivid, detailed, and knowledgeable account of the war in Iraq to appear in any medium. Salam Pax takes his place in this new literary form and in his way of viewing war through a lens of dark humor alongside such voices as Joseph Heller and Kurt Vonnegut. Salam Pax's blog, published as a book, has been translated into 13 languages, most recently Turkish and Chinese. It is a sharp, candid, touching, unexpectedly funny, overwhelmingly immediate record of the anticipation, anger, resentment, and sheer terror felt by an ordinary man living through the final days of Saddam's regime, the American-led invasion that followed, the growing insurgency, and the uncertainties of the recent election, continuing to the present day as Iraq quivers at the brink of civil war. Salam Pax is the first blogger to be invited to the Center for Literary Arts in its nearly two decades of running the Major Author Series. We've had 28 winners of the Pulitzer Prize, but no bloggers. The time is right, and Salam Pax is the right blogger. We are very proud to present Salam Pax's first visit to any major literary series. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Salam Pax, the Baghdad blogger.
Thank you. Thanks very much. Thank you, and thank you very much for coming tonight. Thanks, Mitch, for that lovely introduction. We're getting into our fourth year of the war in Iraq, and a lot has happened. And tonight I'd like to share with you some of the events and some of the things that have happened over the last 3 years. In April 2003, during the early days of Operation Iraqi Freedom, a New York Times reporter moving with American troops as they entered the city of Najaf wrote that an Iraqi standing on the side of the road watching as the U.S. Army rolled into town was asked what he wanted now that the Ba'athists have been removed and driven out of the city. The Iraqi answered in his broken English, democracy, whiskey, and sexy. And according to the journalist, this answer was met with a roar of approval. To tell you the truth, I've always believed this was some sort of an urban myth. I mean, someone living in the holiest Shia city asking for whiskey and sex isn't very likely, but I loved it, and it still makes me smile. I had made a banner of these words at the time, and it was going to be my slogan for all the good things that are going to happen in Iraq. Recently, I decided to throw it away, as we had to move house. We used to live in the west of Baghdad, a suburb called Amriya. We used to live in a typical Iraqi two-story house, and it's not really the nicest of neighborhoods, but all my uncles and aunts lived there, and it was home. But lately, that part of the city had become a stronghold for the Islamist insurgents. By day, our neighborhood might be controlled by Iraqi and U.S. forces, but at night, the insurgents rule. And sometimes we would decide not even to visit my uncle who lives across the street because we would be worried about insurgent attacks. And on one really horrible occasion, We had to call medics to come pick up pieces of bodies from my uncle's front garden after a violent attack on the main street. We're now going into the fourth year of war, and you probably have seen countless attempts to put these last 3 years in Iraq in some sort of perspective. Today, I ask you to put all these attempts aside, and I give you, as a long tradition of Salam Pak's Guide to Iraq, the Democracy, Whiskey, and Sex Guide. You see, that mythical Iraqi gentleman might have said these words as a joke, but I actually believe that these three words address three important issues we're dealing with in my country today: personal freedom, religious freedom, and the more difficult question regarding government systems. But before I go into that, I think we need to establish what is Iraq's status today. 4 years in, and I can't describe exactly what has happened to us. Have you been invaded, liberated, occupied? Are we still fighting, or maybe all of the above? And internally, we still need to make up our minds whether we are having civil war or fighting Islamic militants who've come in from neighboring Saudi Arabia and Syria. And with the decisiveness that all the Salam Pak's guides, I'd like to announce here that Iraq's status is still pending, and probably will still be pending for another couple of years until everyone agrees on what to call this mess we're in now at the moment. And now I'd like to start my highly scientific analysis of the situation. I would like to start it with that wonderful concept, democracy. The one word that has become the reason why bombs were dropped on us after failing to find the weapons of mass destruction or Saddam's al-Qaeda friends. It seems that around 15 years ago, a memo concerning democracy was circulated around the world, but the whole Middle East missed it. The West had decided that rearing friendly dictatorships was out and promoting democracy was in. Do you have any idea how confusing this must have been to all the lovely dictators we have back home? Just a decade ago, having a dictator on a leash was a fashionable accessory to every superpower. But suddenly, the U.S. administration had decided that the world needed a makeover. Our Islamic wardrobe did not fit the decade's fashions, and the corruption in our countries was making the world look cluttered. Something had to be done fast, and we became part of a global extreme makeover show. I like to call it Democratic Eye for the Dictatorship Guy. We were handed flat, packed, instant democracy kits and told, shape up by the next episode. The problem was that the people responsible for this massive show didn't like to listen to the people whose lives were supposedly being transformed. I mean, does the queer eye ever listen to the straight guys whinging? No. So why should this show? But I keep wanting to ask, sir, hasn't it occurred to you that feeding your pet dictators on a diet of tanks and bullets meant that absolutely no culture of political activism has survived, that all political discourse was suffocated and there is no middle ground left? Just look at us now in Iraq. Iraq was forced into shock democracy by blowing the chair from under Saddam's backside, and the only parties organized enough after all these years of political persecution were the religious parties coming from abroad. Today, to live in the Middle East, you feel that you're under the constant pressure of having to change. Not that there is anything wrong with change. It's just that I worry the will to change has not come fully from within. And the speed of this change is like a crash diet. You wait a bit and all these pounds will come back. You want an example? I can ask you to look at our elections. The U.S. administration removed the tyrant in Iraq in order to have a free and democratic elections and governments. But look at what the people chose. Iraqis chose an Islamic government that is friendlier to Iran than the U.S., and it feels like we are replacing one sort of dictatorship with another. And now I feel I need someone to answer the question, what do I do with a democracy that brings in an undemocratic government? But really, all these big concepts, democracy and freedom, believe me, the moment you start fearing seriously for your and your loved one's life, you start worrying about daily bombings and kidnappings. And the moment mothers are too worried to send their kids to school, these big ideas fly out of the window. Yes, we voted 3 times within a year and a half. We dipped our fingers in purple ink and all that. But really, how much has that improved our lives? You know, one of the most tragic things I've heard recently was a couple of my mother's friends sitting in our front garden reminiscing about the good old days 3 years ago. I used to get really angry with talk like that. How could you ever say that your life under Saddam used to be better? But today, I just feel sad and shut up because it is true. You see, it is the difference between the devil we used to know and the problems we have today, the feeling of insecurity, the fear of losing our country and our place in the world. My mother and most of her friends don't go out as much as they used to these days. Actually, we all don't anymore. It is practically mad to be out on the street after 5 p.m. And a week ago, the last of my 4 uncles living where we used to live moved out because it was too dangerous to stay there. They were waking up to dead bodies on the street. But that wasn't actually the last straw. The last straw was the death of the Shia family that owned the store at the end of the street. They were all killed on one day, men, women, and kids. As you know, Shia and Sunni are the 2 major sects in Islam. And that was a Shia family living in a Sunni neighborhood. And apparently, this is not acceptable in the new Iraq. These families, including my own, lived there for the last 20 years. This sort of worry, this fear, is new to us. Religion matters today in Iraq. Which brings me to the next parameter in my democracy, whiskey, and sex investigation. I would like to talk about whiskey for a bit now. Iraq is a Muslim country. No surprises there. But it was never a dry country. There haven't been any bars in Iraq for the last 15 years, but you can buy all the booze you wanted and go get wasted at home. To sell it, you had to be a non-Muslim, but really you could buy it anywhere, with the exception of Najaf, which is the holiest Shia city for Muslims. And you could buy alcohol all over Iraq. That was until a couple of months ago, when off-license stores started getting RPG'd, rocket-propelled grenades launched at them. Today, out of Iraq's 18 governorates, 12 are dry, not by any official decree. The drought is enforced by zealous citizens and political parties with religious agendas. In the south of Iraq, you might be able to get an AK-47 through a checkpoint, but not a single bottle of alcohol. Things got so desperate in Basra that there are rumors alcohol is being smuggled into the city from Iran, out of all places. Looking back, the rise of Muslim parties after the war should not have been a surprise. During the last 10 years, Saddam took a religious turn and supported Sunni sects to keep the Shia under control. That's on one side. On the other, look who the U.S. and U.K. were talking to when they were preparing for Operation Iraqi Freedom. The Supreme Council of the Islamic Revolution, the Islamic Dawah Party, and a couple of other religious Shia clerics. These were obviously not secular parties. They're very religious, and one of them is actually reared in Iran, which, as you know, is much more fundamentalist than Iraq is, and some of these parties' members have unashamedly sectarian agendas. So these parties marched in following the coalition forces, and when the time came to form the first Iraqi transitional government, the U.S. decided to allocate seats on that government by sect and ethnicity. And that was all these parties needed to feel there is nothing wrong with emphasizing their sectarian identities. And then again, when the first general elections in Iraq looked like it was going to fail, the U.S. and Iraqi officials didn't call on all Iraqis to help make it a success. They went to the highest-ranking Shia cleric in Iraq, Ayatollah Ali Sistani, and asked him for backing. The chorus of turbans was told they matter, and it is very difficult to stop them singing. Today, not only the Iraqi political scene is controlled by the religious parties, but our daily lives too. Ask me why I have a beard. I have a beard because I wanted to go visit at the south during a religious festival, and it is better to be seen as religious. And later on, I kept it because it's good to keep everyone confused. Many barbers in Baghdad refuse to shave beards today, not because they're so religious, but because many of their colleagues have been killed or threatened if they do, which reeks to me too much of the Taliban in Afghanistan. For one of my video blogs, I went to visit Amara for 10 days, a city in the Shiite south that is under the control of the British forces. Amara is an interesting city because it has been home to Shia and Sunni Muslims, Christians, Jews, and Mandians for a very long time. In case you are wondering who the Mandians are, they are a religious minority who believe John the Baptist is their prophet and their holy book is written in Aramaic, which they still speak. Unfortunately, during my visit, I only got to see the leftovers of this diversity. I was taken on a tour to see the walls of the old synagogue and the Jewish quarter, which, to tell you the truth, was very amazing, because the Arab nationalistic parties like the Ba'ath Party made sure none of Iraq's Jewish heritage stayed intact elsewhere. I also visited one of the two Christian churches there, two of the oldest in Iraq, and I heard how all the Christian families were driven out of the city. Their businesses were attacked and they had to leave. And after the latest episode of civil unrest in Iraq, Sunni Muslims there were also attacked. Call it what you want to call it, but it's just wrong. It feels too much that the Shia in the south are making sure no unwanted elements are living in their bit of Iraq before they form their own state in the south, just like the Kurds did in the north. And another very interesting example of the rise of Shiite extremists into politics is Muqtada al-Sadr. No one has heard of him before the war, but in the last 3 years, he held a whole city under siege for 4 weeks when the U.S. authority issued an arrest warrant on him. He formed his own militia, the Mehdi Army, which has been accused of being part of the death squads we keep hearing of these days, and announced he's prepared to use his militia to defend Iran. His party, after the recent elections, is in the House of Representatives. And if you believe some of the analysts, that party and its sympathizers make about 13% of the government. That is what the much-celebrated democracy allowed to happen. A 30-year-old who couldn't form a coherent sentence when he did his first interview 3 years ago has the power to decide what my future looks like only because he wears a turban. I think you get my drift. Many Iraqis today wear their religion on their sleeves, and I'm not happy about that. This is not what was supposed to happen. I could go on and on about how Islam rules our lives today, but you'd get bored and I'd get depressed. So I suggest we move on to more interesting things. Sex. Or to paraphrase that, personal freedom. 3 years on, and we wonder if Mr. Iraqi Najaf is getting the sexy he asked for. Now, remember, Iraq is an Islamic country, so getting any out of wedlock is A, difficult, B, socially stigmatized. You'd have to get married. And yes, there has been a rise in number of marriages due to the marked improvement of incomes. The salary of a freshly employed civil servant rose from $30 to a whopping $100 a month, and they all want to get married. So with lots of new marriages and the 10 p.m. curfew in Baghdad, you would think there would be lots of time for fun behind closed doors. Unfortunately, anecdotal evidence tells us that your mojo doesn't deal well with the stress of random bombings and daily suicide attacks. However, there is a small percentage whose mojo goes to overdrive, survival instincts and all that, I presume. But joking aside, between the rise of the religious parties and the total lawlessness in Iraq, we have lost a lot of our personal freedom and security. Take the issues of women's rights. The Iraq my parents knew was a very different Iraq to the one we live in now. We had the highest literacy rate for women in the region, and the Iraqi Women's League was the first of its kind in the Middle East campaigning for the rights of women. My mother comes from a big family. She has 6 sisters and three brothers. All of her sisters went to university, graduated, and worked as physicians, lawyers, and even though they came from a very religiously conservative background, no one told them they had to wear the veil. The sight of a young woman wearing a veil used to bring puzzled looks and the question is if anything is wrong. Unfortunately, since the fall of Saddam's regime, it seems we've lost a lot of that. Very early on after the war, women in cities in the Shiite south and some districts in Baghdad were harassed if they were not wearing the hijab, the headscarf. And some religious parties even set up offices in girls' school to make sure the teenage girls came in veil. But more alarming is the trend to limit women's rights in the new laws that are being written in my country today. As early as the U.S. formed governing council, some of the Islamist parties tried to change certain paragraphs that were in Iraqi civil law since the 50s and guaranteed certain rights for women. These laws gave full rights to women and bypassed Islamic law, like, for example, the fact that Islamic inheritance law gives women only half what men get, and also in court of law, a woman's testimony accounts for only half of a man's. Members of the Supreme Council of the Islamic Revolution, a very powerful Shiite party, wanted to reinstate Islamic law, or as we call it, Sharia, and remove certain paragraphs from Iraqi civil law when they were in the governing council, and they tried again when Iraq was writing its new constitution. It took the efforts of very few brave women, women's rights activists, and the insistence of the U.S. representative in Iraq to stop this. Even things like the enforced 25% quota for women in Iraq's House of Representatives had to be enforced by the United States ambassador. During the last 2 years, we saw a lot of our personal liberties eroded or being limited, not only because of the religious constraints, but because of the rising crime in Iraq. For example, trucks delivering money to banks get dropped regularly, and if you are planning on making a big withdrawal from a bank, you better have a gun with you, or actually, you better not even have a big account in Baghdad these days. And you might only hear about kidnappings when Western journalists are kidnapped, but the truth is almost 30 Iraqis get kidnapped every day in Iraq, mainly for ransom, not for political reasons. Three of my cousins have been kidnapped over the last 3 years. The second was killed even though his family paid the ransom. University professors are killed because students don't like their grades. Physicians are threatened when operations are not successful. And there is no one you can turn to. We don't trust the police. We don't trust the army. And you are basically left on your own. And that's why more Iraqis are leaving the country today than they used to do under Saddam's rule. We are losing the educated middle class that was supposed to become the base the new Iraq is built on. And the irony is, while before the war, Iraqis could seek political asylum in other countries, today their petitions for asylum are refused on the basis that Iraq is now a free and liberated country. 3 years ago, as the discussion about a possible war in Iraq was getting louder, I thought this might be good. Finally, we will be rid of Saddam and his party, and we could make a great thing out of Iraq. Even though getting rid of that tyrant meant having to make a deal with the devil and go through a war, but I had faith in Iraqis and in their ability to rebuild Iraq and its society. I wasn't expecting much from the so-called coalition of the willing. They are an invading army, after all, and there are always limits to what they would be able to do or willing to do. Looking back at how things developed, I have to admit that the optimism I used to express 2 years ago makes me look like a fool today. Things have gone so wrong. There was a brief moment after the fall of Baghdad that was filled with hope and optimism. The wishes for democracy, whiskey, and sexy seemed just around the corner, but unfortunately that didn't last long. There was a short time in which Iraqis invited American soldiers into their homes, and soldiers showed kids the strange gadgets they carry with them. But political decisions made thousands of miles from Iraq changed that, and both sides lost trust of each other. To put it bluntly, the U.S. administration seems quite good at pissing people off in Iraq instead of winning them on their good side. And boy, did they have the wrong advisors. Instead of listening to Iraqis in Iraq, the U.S. administration kept listening to Iraqis who have been outside the country for 30 years or more. They had absolutely no idea how it felt like to be an Iraqi. You might look at the situation today and ask, how could I not see it go wrong? I tell you why. I trusted the Iraqis. I believe that we would be able to take this mess created by the war and make something good out of it. But unfortunately, Iraqi politicians kept making all the wrong decisions also. Government corruption and the settling of old political scores seems to be what's on their mind, instead of doing something good for the people who elected them. Sometimes it looks like they're all just a bunch of vultures who couldn't care less for the welfare of the country. We keep hearing that money from oil exports and foreign aid is being spent on rebuilding, but we haven't seen any real reconstruction. We suffer from fuel shortages, electricity shortages, our hospitals are under-equipped, and the buildings which were bombed are still empty wrecks. But we do hear that there is a new big U.S. embassy being built in the Safe Green Zone, though. Thomas Friedman asked in a recent article, was Iraq the way Iraq was because Saddam was the way Saddam was? Or was Saddam the way Saddam was because Iraq was the way Iraq was? A country congenitally divided among Shiites, Sunnis, and Kurds that can be held together only by an iron fist. I find this a very interesting question, because today, Iraq looks more fragmented than it ever was. And maybe the only way forward for us is to concede that we just cannot live together peacefully. It is sad, and definitely not what was supposed to happen. But I, for myself, am tired, and many Iraqis feel the same. Tired of the politics, of the violence, and feeling afraid all the time. And would almost do anything just to get our lives back to some form of normality, even if it meant bringing back that iron fist. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Salam, for your very candid, thoughtful, and incisive comments about the situation in your country. My name is Dan Polcrano. I'm the executive editor of the Metro Newspaper Group here in San Jose, California, and I'll be your moderator for this evening's question and answer session. We have a number of excellent questions from our audience tonight. We won't be able to get to them all, but let's jump right into it. And since this is Silicon Valley, why don't we start with a question about your blog. Were you, Salam, were you surprised by the popularity of your blog? How did you gauge the popularity? Did you have any stat programs or anything to gauge it? And where were you writing it? And were you ever afraid of being discovered?
I wasn't really aware of the popularity of the blog. I mean, you do get emails and people ask questions through email, and there is a sort of a little counter on the side. But I wasn't really aware how much widely read it was until I was I got an email from someone at Google who owned Blogspot at the time and said, we would like to keep that web blog on, and we're going to set up a mirror site because our servers are getting too much traffic. So I guess that means there was a lot of traffic going through that. The web blog itself, I mean, it was interesting for me to find out about the, you know, blogging and web blogs, because up until that moment, really, the internet just felt like a glorified encyclopedia. I had no idea why everybody was so excited about it. And then I discover blogs. I see how people write about their daily lives, how they share their thoughts with the rest of the world through the internet. And the moment I started my own weblog, it opened a whole new window. I mean, Iraq was basically a big prison, and you'd never be able to take a look at what's going on outside. And people were not also to look into Iraq as well. The weblog, my weblog, and other weblogs allowed me to do that.
Where were you doing your writing, and how is it that you were not discovered, or were you afraid of being discovered?
The internet was really new. I mean, the first time internet was offered at home for us in Iraq was 2002, and It sort of was a bit of a cat and mouse game. It was new for us, and it was also new for the government. They hadn't really set up a very good firewall, and it was very easy to get around that. And this being the internet, all you had to do was ask a question, and someone will answer you. They will give you little hints and ways to get around firewalls. So you would only have to be, foolish enough and sort of stop worrying about being caught by the government, which is very foolish thing to do, and go online. Going online wasn't that easy. Going online meant that you had to give in lots of information about yourself. You signed loads of papers that you're never going to do anything that's illegal, all that stuff. But the moment you had the internet, it's such an eye opener, and not wanting to engage yourself in that dialogue with the other. Is I think pretty lazy if you have that tool in your hand.
So you were sitting at home with a computer typing?
Yeah. I mean, mostly from home, sometimes from the office. The first time I actually was able to go online was from the office where I worked, and I wasn't really their best architect, so usually I'd be sitting without any work to do and sort of fiddling with things online, and that's how I discovered weblogs.
Let's shift gears here. Who are the insurgents? Are they Iraqis or foreign nationals? And why do ordinary Iraqis help the insurgencies do things like blow up pipelines that are intended for the reconstruction of Iraq?
The insurgents are a mix of people. They are partly religious fundamentalists, partly Ba'athists and Saddamists who supported Saddam and still support him, and people who've been wronged pretty badly by the coalition forces. All these people have got together in one way or another and became what we call today the insurgency. There are obviously foreign militants. There are people coming from the neighboring countries. We have huge problems with our borders. People coming from Iran, from Syria, from Saudi Arabia, and there is enough sympathy towards these Islamic fundamentalists in Iraq to keep them, to harbor them, and to work with them. It is a huge problem, but it hasn't been helped, it hasn't been sort of made easier to solve by certain actions from the coalition forces and from the Iraqi government. The Iraqi government and the West in general at the moment keeps demonizing cities and areas in Iraq just because certain elements or certain tribes there do the these bombings and these suicide attacks. What you end up with is not just a family or a group of people who are angry, but a whole city. You need to look at Fallujah, you need to look at Mosul, you need to look at today maybe Samarra because of the current bombings on these cities. You create, by these actions, angry people, and these people will lend their ears and maybe their help to insurgents. It's a very difficult issue for us to deal with in Iraq because these are our neighbors, these are family members, and it feels like they're turning on us. It's very difficult to understand how a fellow Iraqi is prepared to kill other Iraqis. We wanted to believe that these were all foreign combatants, that these were all people coming from these evil neighboring countries. But unfortunately, it's not. There was a time when the media here and maybe even the U.S. administration wanted everybody to believe that all of these people were foreign combatants. Basically, they called them. They were fighting foreign combatants in Iraq. They're not all foreigners, unfortunately. Many of them are Iraqis. It's difficult to point at them. It's constantly shifting, and it depends on where the political scene is sort of moving around. I mean, at the moment, you have a lot of the Sunnis involved in the Iraqi government, which meant that certain insurgent factions have stopped doing suicide bombings. But others, you have now Shia factions who decided they want to do their own little action in Iraq now. It's a constantly changing picture. And I would not be able to actually point at a certain part of Iraq or a certain group of people and say, these are the insurgents. If anyone could do that, we would have solved our problem. But unfortunately, it's not a very easy question to answer.
For those of you at home, we're talking with Salim Pax, the Baghdad blogger. We have a good question here about your thoughts about the U.S. government position on torture, both in what happened at the Abu Ghraib prison, as well as the new definitions of torture outside the Geneva Conventions, and how this is affecting the perception of American-style democracy in the eyes of the world.
The U.S. administration keeps constantly sending very confusing and mixed messages to the rest of the world. We hear all this talk about democracy and freedom and things that are right and things that are wrong, what is humane and what is not. But at the same time, we hear of these things that you just mentioned, of definitions of torture and actions done in certain prisons and places. You have to understand that the way most of the Middle East views the U.S. is with a lot of skepticism, and there is very little trust. And the more confusing the views, the more confusing the statements are made by the U.S. administration here, the less we trust the Americans, the less we are able to work with them. I think it's very difficult for I think any intelligent person to sort of reconcile all these conflicting views. We keep trying to understand what do you mean by democracy and freedom when you allow certain types of torture to happen in your prison, when you encourage these types of torture. It's very confusing, and it's very difficult to understand what you exactly want from us, because you see, at the moment it feels like the West wants things from the Middle East. We need to do things in order to stop being bombed, being put under embargo, being politically harassed all the time. And because these views are so very unclear, we don't know what we need to do. The reaction to that ends up being extremism, whether it's political or religious. I think the U.S. administration needs to make up its mind of what it wants from the Middle East and to make very clear definitions about what is democracy, what is freedom, and why it accepts torture in certain forms and why it allows other sorts of torture not to happen.
Is democracy that great a system after all? I mean, its results are unpredictable. Democracy has brought us everyone from George Bush to Hamas, and even Adolf Hitler was democratically elected. Do you think that political systems need to evolve further? And is there any system out there that might be a little better?
You ask pretty big questions, and I... I'm just a blogger, and I'm struggling with all these things as you all do. I'm not a politician, and I avoid I've been trying to avoid making any sort of political statement. And we try to find our way in the world. And for you maybe this system, this democracy, was what you chose or what your grandfathers chose. And you live with it, you understand it, you grew up with it. To impose it the way it was imposed on other countries, to basically tell us within 3 years that we need to evolve highly politically active societies and become and have elections and go vote, it doesn't happen that easily. I mean, it is a wonderful system. Democracy in theory is a wonderful system, and it should work. Otherwise, it wouldn't be something that everybody seeks and goes after. The problem is that you need to have a deep understanding of it. Otherwise, it gives chance to the wrong answers. As you mentioned, all these people were democratically elected, and at the moment we have the same problem with the rise of the religious parties. They were democratically elected. I can't answer the question whether there are better political systems. All I can say is that societies need to develop government systems that are suitable for themselves, and these things only happen over a long period of time. At the moment, what is going on is the West in general is putting so much pressure on other countries that it feels are threatening to that West to change, and part of that change is to become democratic. Many of us don't really know what democratic means. I mean, in Iraq, you had people driving down, the other way around down streets. And when you ask, what are you doing? They turn around and say, isn't this a democracy now? So we don't understand it. We need time. And the pressure we're put under isn't really helping.
Well, since you couldn't answer that question... Which, to be fair, I think Aristotle and Socrates were fussing around with that question a couple thousand years ago, and we still haven't gotten it down. Let me ask you an even more difficult question to answer. Now, we're watching Saddam Hussein's trial on television, and he's grandstanding and obviously doing his best to stir up dissent and make a case against the United States and agitate the masses. Do you think it would have just been cleaner and more efficient to do what Romania did to Ceausescu, which was execute him within 24 hours?
The issue of Saddam's trial is actually... basically, most Iraqis think the case that he's being tried for at the moment is not the one we wanted to see in court. We wanted to see the Halabja case. We wanted to see him being tried for the atrocities he committed in the south, in the Shia south. But these two involved parties other than Iraq. They involved the UK government, the US, other governments who helped Saddam acquire certain types of weapons or allowed him to do certain things. And we ended up with a case that is really not very clear. It is very difficult for the judges and for the prosecution to deal with that flimsy evidence. But the truth is we're tired of seeing Saddam on our televisions, and everyone in Iraq really awaits one single sentence, and that is execution. You might think it's wrong, you might think it's inhumane, but the truth is we're really tired of him. And the only thing that sort of keeps us patient is the fact that within the laws that were written during the transitional government under the U.S. administration, is that once a sentence is issued, the sentence has to be effective within 14 days, meaning if he is sentenced to be executed, he will be executed within 14 days. The Kurds and the Shia are very unhappy about this because this means their cases will never be brought to court. But on the other hand, it will mean that we can finally put that part of our history to rest. We're very tired of having to constantly listen to Saddam. My mother can't watch these. I mean, they put them on television from 11 in the morning until 6 in the afternoon, these trials, three times a week. And, You watch it because you want to know what will happen to him and what he's saying, but at the same time, it hurts you to keep listening to him. So you might, you know, as wrong as it sounds, I would rather see the end of him very quickly. We need to get over that part of our history and hopefully move into something else.
Salam, many Americans are starting to question whether it was a wise idea to get involved in Iraq. Do you believe that the invasion and the war was a mistake?
That is again a difficult question. I keep being asked that question for the last 3 years. Are you with it, for it, or against it? It's not that clear, and it's never that easy to answer. We Iraqis were waiting for the day we would get rid of Saddam. The problem was that it was very clear for us that we would never be able to do it on our own. We needed foreign intervention. And we basically had to make this deal with the devil, and we never knew what the outcome would be. But we bought this. We bought the war. We bought bringing in an invader in order to get rid of Saddam, and we hoped that we'd be able to turn it around. Unfortunately, everything that happened after that day, after the fall of Saddam's regime, seems to have gone wrong. Partly because of the U.S. administration's wrong decisions, and partly because of Iraqis who couldn't get their act together. So whether it was right or wrong to get involved, I mean, if you look at it, the U.S. administration never did it because they wanted to be nice to Iraqis and help us to get rid of Saddam. They had their own reasons. And I wish I could say we are very grateful and thankful. I was hoping that day would come soon when we would say, thank you very much, can you now leave our country? Unfortunately, we are all now in this mess. And I personally think if you break it, you buy it, and you basically will have to help us get out of the mess we're in now.
Yeah, I think that's called the Pottery Barn Rule. Well, we do ask some tough questions here in Northern California, and which is also the home of, I think, which will be a little bit easier question. This is where gay marriage has been a big issue. There's several questions from the audience about what is it like for gay people in Iraq, and what kind of issues are being confronted in the public sector now.
If you look at the, what's going on in Iraq these days, the last on our minds are gay and lesbian rights, to tell you the truth. I mean, what we need at the moment is just basic human rights, just that we as people can live our lives peacefully. There are so many unresolved issues, and when I get asked a question like that, it's a bit amusing to think that it's everything is so nice and we've dealt with all our problems, then we can now think about gay and lesbian issues. Unfortunately, it's not that easy. It is so far away. Iraq is so far away from that point. Not only Iraq, the whole Middle East is just basically is not there. So I'm sorry to tell you all. I mean, there was a point where it was almost funny to hear of a couple of gay organizations wanting to set up offices in Iraq and to help gay and lesbian groups there. And they were very kind of rudely informed if they don't get out of the country quickly, something really bad will happen to them. We are really not there. You have to consider we are moving into a region that is even more difficult. We are getting closer to places like Iran, where two young men were killed very recently for being accused of being gay. I'm sorry, guys, but that's the question that is really not part of our agendas at the moment. At the moment, what we need is to establish that I can live my life as peacefully as possible. I can go to work without having to worry that I could be killed for, any sort of reason. And when that happens, when we get that, when we have a stable government, when we know that our lives are stable enough, I think we can go into these issues. Unfortunately, we can't now.
Salem, in the past, media was controlled by large corporations and highly influenced by government agendas and other special interests. Now, with the internet, pretty much anybody with a keyboard can influence the public agenda and get information out. How has this changed the rules of engagement for war, and how has it changed the prospects for tyrants?
I think the internet has made a huge difference to how dictatorships function and how governments who control media work. I mean, once you open that option, once you let people access the internet, you basically broke most of your walls down. You just have to look at us in Iraq. It's really just a really big question, and I don't know whether now it's about journalism or whether it's about governments. Who asked the question?
Well, what the question was getting at is, with the internet, with the fact that suddenly, pretty much anybody can take shots from the side or get information out, does it make people safer? Does it make it harder to wage a war? Does it make it harder for a tyrant to maintain their position?
It does make it harder to hide facts. I mean, basically, once people have a way to express their views, to tell what they've been going through, you basically can't hide this. I mean, the internet lets people tell it as it happens. It is very immediate. It's faster than most news outlets, and sometimes even more sincere and honest. So it is definitely much more difficult to wage wars the way you used to. I mean, even news organizations made that more difficult. Having CNN cameras during the first Gulf War was again one of the reasons, a difficulty to maybe the U.S. administration to do certain things. You have a witness there, a camera. A blogger makes it even more difficult because a blogger cannot be controlled by certain editorial policies. You are your own editor, and you decide what you write. It has definitely changed the way we see news. It has changed the way governments do certain things. I mean, you just look at China, you look at Iran, you look at Saudi, you look at Iraq, and it's very difficult for things to stay hidden. Things will surface because of the internet and because of blogging.
Now, there is, even with cameras, sometimes the cameras sometimes lie, and there are photo ops. One thing that many Americans have been wondering is, remember when the statue was taken down? Was that a planned photo op, an orchestrated media event, or was that just some spontaneous thing that happened?
It is sort of slightly funny and curious that out of all the statues of Saddam in the city of Baghdad, the one nearest to journalists was pulled down. So, if you want to be someone who sort of kind of a bit skeptical and believes in conspiracy theories, I would say, yes, that was a photo op.
Now, in recent days, we saw the Kurdish museum that was created to memorialize the mass killing that occurred there all of a sudden be destroyed by their own people, the Kurds. And for many Americans, this was kind of puzzling. Can you tell us a little bit about what happened there?
I'm afraid I can't. I have to tell you something about Iraq and Kurdistan. Kurdistan has been practically independent for the last 16 years now. At the moment, Kurdistan almost feels like a foreign country to me. I visited during the last 3 years only once and was not very welcome there. They don't like Arabs. And if I want to go again today, I would have to get something that is very similar to a visa. I have to report to a certain office because I'm Arab, and they would issue me a permit to stay for a maximum of 7 days. Kurdistan is staying within that unit that we call Iraq at the moment because the Arabs and the Kurds have certain things that they can sort of benefit from each other. But I am sure that the Kurdish people would want to have their own separate country as fast as they can. And I'm very sad about this. I would love to see Iraq the way I grew up seeing. But to answer your, I can't really answer your question because Kurdistan, for me at the moment, is practically a foreign country, unfortunately.
One questioner asks, points out that the USA is still in Korea and Germany and Japan, and wonders if the U.S. will still be in Iraq in 2090. Now, obviously, we don't think you can predict the future with any degree of perfection, but what's your view? Is this a semi-permanent occupation?
It's sort of interesting that there is a huge U.S. embassy complex being built now in Iraq. That's a sort of indication of what sort of interest, what the future might look like. We've been hearing about military bases, but how the media is and how these issues are usually never openly discussed. So it's only rumors. But the only indication I have is there is a very big U.S. embassy complex being built within the Green Zone. So I guess you're at least there for another 15 years, yeah.
There's also some pipelines being built as well, both in Iraq and neighboring Afghanistan. Some people think that the motivations for the war were things other than simply retaliating against a terrorist attack on the United States and making the world safer for U.S. citizens. Do you think that economic motivations played a role in the decision of the Bush administration to invade Iraq, or that Mr. Bush's religious views were a factor in the decisions he made?
I hope it was not his religious views. That would mean we are in a very strange sort of war. I think economic factors have definitely played a role. The U.S. administration didn't basically help us Iraqis because they were being nice to, Iraqis over there. They have their own reasons. And part of it is oil, part of it is this war on terror. But I think if you look at the situation now, the world is not a safer place with Saddam removed. It's become even more dangerous. Iraq has become a strange magnet for all sorts of fundamentalists and terrorists. So I'm afraid that argument just failed. The economic argument, well, Iraq has been exporting less and less oil over the last couple of months. There were a couple of months where oil exports have gone down to a third to what they were before the war. So even that argument seems to be not working. I have no idea why the war was waged.
Well, let's try another question, which you may or may not be qualified to answer. People, it's amazing. When you write a book...
You see,
You're an expert on everything, right?
No, it's just that lots of these answers sort of assume you'd need a politician to answer a lot of these questions. And what I can tell you about is about life in Iraq. I can tell you about how life is for us in Baghdad these days. A lot of these questions are questions I struggle with and I try to answer for myself. Unfortunately, you know, we're all in this, and we ended up all in this together. I can't answer most of these questions. I have no idea why my country was bombed, and I don't know whether democracy is the solution for us. These are questions we Iraqis struggle with, just as you do. And our politicians, unfortunately, just like yours, are very good at confusing us and not answering these questions.
Well, let me just ask one last question, which obviously depends on your ability to predict the future as well. But with Iran developing an apparent nuclear capability, if it is not solved by negotiation or diplomacy, and let's say that the United States or Israel decides to take military action to take out the nascent nuclear capability in Iran, what is likely to be the reaction in the Arab world?
Again, thank you. I don't know. you assume here that some sort of hard politician is standing in front of you. There will be a reaction which is mostly going to be angry and indignant and attacking, waging a war now on Iran seems to be, I'm sorry to say, the stupidest thing anyone can do at the moment. Iraq is falling apart. You create even more instability in the region by waging war on Iran now. I can't really believe that someone would have so much, so little understanding of the situation to do that. It's very difficult to believe that either Israel or the U.S. are going to do that. If it happens, it would be very difficult to predict what goes on. I mean, the whole region just falls apart. Unfortunately, I don't know. I'm not a politician. I can't answer these questions.
Thank you, Salim. I'm Dan Polcrano, and now we'll turn the program back to Mitch.
I hope you all enjoyed tonight's program. Again, we would like to thank Salam Pax, the Baghdad blogger, Dan Polcrano, executive editor and CEO of Metro Newspapers, our audience here in San Jose, and those of you joining us on the radio. And now this broadcast of the Center for Literary Arts and the Student Union, Inc. of San Jose University and the Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley, part of the nation's largest and oldest public affairs forum, is adjourned.